himself, and then he would go to bed. It wasn't right, what he'd been thinking before when they were dancing. It couldn't happen. Not here, not now, not ever. "Have you got a spare?" she said, coming out to meet him. He felt her before he saw her. The stars were very bright, pure, silver, cyclical. Night clouds moved across them in a soft wind, and then they shone out alone, brighter than anything. "Thanks," she said, blowing out. She slipped her arm through his and leaned her head on his shoulder. They watched the sky. "I like you, Damien. You're on my tip." He didn't move, didn't speak, just concentrated on getting to the end of his cigarette and remembering what he was supposed to do next. There were two Melissas, he was coming to realize. There was the one who lived in the world outwardly, who was bold and mocking and a little ruthless, and there was this other one, who was quiet and uncertain, much softer. He liked this one more, though it could not exist without the other. It was the price for the other. "Can I tell you another secret?" she said.
"What?"
"I don't want to go home."
"Neither do I."
"There's something bad at home."
"I know."
He put his arm around her. It was close, innocent, like last time. "You always understand," she said. "You never try and solve anything. I can't always explain how I feel or why I feel like that or what's wrong. Just that something's wrong. You're the only one who seems to..." She was looking at the swimming pool, the water, the lines on the surface moving with the breeze. It made her think of the dream. He was holding her body. They were surrounded by coldness, but she was warm. How loose and oblivious the water looked. "I want to be free," she said in a strange murmur. "I wish we could just be free. Why do we live this way?" She was out of herself and too deep inside herself, but he did understand. He understood completely. He said,
"How long will we go on living our lives as if we were
balancing on a ribbon?" She finished.
"What? Hey, what did you just say?"
But she was walking towards the pool. It was calling her, the dark, silent water. She didn't stop, even when he asked her where she was going. What did she mean? How did she know? It felt as if she were inside him, even as she reached the edge. As she slid in her pretty polka dot dress, which billowed around her. That they were connected by this ribbon, which was white and silk and strong. She gasped at the cold water against her skin, laughing, and even then she was inside him. Her mouth wide open, even as her face went under and came back up.
"Hey, be careful, don't drown on me."
He was standing at the edge. His voice sounded like it was coming from somewhere else.
"It's lovely. It's freezing. Come in."
She beckoned with both arms, like a child, and held in her spell, he sat down on the rim. It took him longer to go in. Every inch of the ice was shocking, excruciating, but soon he was submerged. He was swimming, sliding through, trying to get warm, laughing with her, and there was nothing between them anymore. Nothing to say that it was wrong. They were free. The ribbon was broken. He came close to her. He tried one last time to hold it back, but the next thing, he was kissing her, and she lay back in his arms, afloat, curious. She opened herself to his mouth. Why not go and look for a cousin of Desdemona? Some strange and waiting kiss, some sister of her friend, or some friend of her sister. She went with him, and he engulfed her as she had wanted him to. His thick hands slipped under and followed her skin quickly and with fear. It was a kind of gorgeous dreaming, a fantasy unfolding. They entered the dark possibility, and for a little while it still glittered, the warmth and the revelation of it. But what they ultimately found was that there was less there than they had thought there would be. There in the ice, hungry, fast, he was no kind of freedom. and she was no kind of saviour. His tongue was rough, unknowing. His stubble scratched against her face. And when he was inside her, under the water, she wanted it to stop, but couldn't find a way to tell him. She was embarrassed. It seemed already too late. So she let him carry on. She turned to stone. While it was happening, she thought of Simon, that boy from all those years ago when she was young. That there are people who touch, who should not touch, and once they touch, all their talking is ruined. That is how it was. Chapter 13. This is it. Sometimes, in the lives of ordinary people, there is a great halt, a revelation, a moment of change. It occurs under low mental skies, never when one is happy. You are walking along on a crumbling road. The tarmac is falling away beneath your feet, and you have started to limp. You are wearing rags. A cruel wind is blowing against your face. It feels as though you have been walking for a very long time. You are losing hope. You are losing meaning. And the only thing keeping you going is that stubborn human instinct to proceed. Then immediately up ahead, you see something. Something bright and completely external to your own life. It is so bright that it makes you squint. You see it. You squint. And you stop. For Damien, this happened on the morning of Thursday, 25th of June. It happened in the television. A thin man stepped onto the road and centered himself in the middle of it. He had black shoulder-length hair and a pale, unnatural face. He was wearing a pair of glittering electric blue trousers that ended just above the ankle, white socks and black dancing shoes. From his thin, bone-coloured torso hung a jacket of the same glittering blue. He stood there in Damien's path, blindingly bright, blue fabric shimmering, ankle swingers swinging, one white hand raised almost in beckoning, and Damien stopped walking. He saw him. He squinted, and he stopped. On this morning of the 25th of June, he woke up late for the third time that week. The house was empty. The children had gone to school. Stephanie had taken them there, and then, he assumed, she had gone somewhere else, somewhere wherever he was not, which was now her way. When Damien was in the living room, Stephanie was in the kitchen. When Damien was in the bedroom, Stephanie was in the garden, sweeping the patio at strange hours, pruning the petunias to unbearable perfection. The garden was looking so good now that Damien felt he hardly had a right to be in it, let alone smoke in it. So he still smoked in the driveway, like a fugitive, late at night, and Stephanie didn't seem to care. She never looked straight at him at the dinner table anymore. Though since Avril's panic attack, she was also extra careful not to let it be obvious to the children that there was a wall between them, resulting in occasional pseudo eye contact. She would look at his eyebrow instead of his iris, or sometimes, perhaps, his eyelid. She would say something like, "Summer, tell Daddy about that experiment you did today," and Summer would tell him. There would be a strained, dull listening in which Damien was trying to appear genuinely fascinated, and when he had finished expressing this fascination with something like, "That sounds really interesting, I wish I could have been there too," the conversation would turn back into the livelier, happier avenues they all preferred. Or so it seemed to him. He was an outsider, a ghost at the side of the house in the dark, risking cancer of the lung. Did she know? He wondered. The first thought that entered his head every morning. There were no longer those initial moments of pure, thought-free consciousness that precede full wakefulness, which surely everyone deserves. No, it came straight away, every day. Did she know? Was she waiting for him to confess? And the longer he didn't confess, the angrier and more prone to divorce consideration she would become. Or did she not know, and she was angry about something else? Was she just tired of him and considering divorcing him anyway? Divorce. It seemed such a hefty, catastrophic thing for a person to go through. It didn't seem so revolutionary and dynamic anymore, only scary, and not for him. And if she didn't know, to continue with this anxiety-fueling line of questioning, should he tell her? Should he? Or should he let it slide? Would she even care if he did tell her? Was it such a big deal anyway? He didn't know what to do. He was stuck. The road was hard. The tarmac was crumbling. He was limping. He was wearing rags. Specifically, a pair of old Nike shorts and a dirty white vest. Underneath the covers, he was sweating. It was unusually hot outside and had been for days. A feverish, scorching kind of heat that made normal life seem ludicrous, where the only thing to do was lie down and bathe in it, to drift, to dream hot, blue, oceanic dreams, of which, incidentally, he was having nothing of the kind. He was having frantic, terrible dreams, last night, for instance, of his head being cut off, and then the head turning into Melissa's head. Plus, he was having headaches, and he knew, with a quiet shame, that he smelt bad. He needed to shower. Yesterday he had not been able to. He needed to get dressed and go to work. But all of this seemed impossible today. He couldn't go to work because of all the things he had to do beforehand. Every easy thing seemed difficult, and every difficult thing indistinct. The only possible thing was to have a cigarette, and it was this first matutinal craving, that finally gave him the motivation to fling off the covers and sit upright. For a little while, he stared at the wall in front of him, the violet colour that Stephanie had chosen. Within it, a photograph of a short pier going out into the sea, which was grey, misty and mysterious. Someone had just jumped, or someone was about to jump. The cigarettes were downstairs in the vase cupboard. He wanted to smoke here, upstairs, with the curtains drawn, but he was afraid of Stephanie finding out. She might come back at any moment, or she would smell it, and that would make things even worse. She had always despised the smell of cigarette smoke. Damien was realizing now, in this cold ostracism from her love and tenderness, that Stephanie's love and tenderness and that ability of hers to transmit contentment were a warmth in his life that he wanted. He had forgotten this. He had shunned her comfort. She had been there for him when Lawrence died, open and giving to him, and he had turned away. And now she was closed and hard-edged, and he was a lone thing with nothing to hold on to. In the thick smog of his self-pity, barefoot, greasy and overstubbled, he dragged himself up and went out onto the landing. The fact of daytime accosted him as he went downstairs, the light streaming in through the stained glass window, the post lying on the doormat, an accusing symbol of industriousness and full functionality. In the kitchen, there was a note from Stephanie. Gone to work, so should you. The time on the radio said 10:13. He would have to call in sick again, and he would, just as soon as he'd had his cigarette. When he lit it, standing outside by the back door, he inhaled deep and long the sweet, small oblivion. Things were better for a minute. The garden was beautiful. He would find his way back into it. He would play with the children in the grass later. He would mow the lawn, be deserving of them again. It was over too quickly, so he had another, then another. Cancer would come, he knew. It would come on a Tuesday, because Tuesday was a cancerous kind of day. With the tar thick in his throat, he came in from the sun, realizing that he was hungry. He wanted toast, some coffee. He filled the kettle, put two slices of bread in the toaster, and wandered into the living room, where he sat down on the blue calico sofa and switched on the TV. That was when it happened. There it was. The road. The thin man shimmering. A white hand. A turn in the leg. Music. Michael Jackson was on every Freeview channel. He was the news, the music, the drama and the ads. He was turning on an axis in his fast and shiny shoes. He was dancing along a street at dusk after a girl in a tight dress, slinking down the smooth criminal stairs in a white tuxedo. 1,000 pelvic thrusts, flying sparks of skittering white socks, idiosyncratic wavings of famous sad white glove. And then, not so mobile. Now, the flashlight, the blue incandescence of sirens. A stretcher in a courtyard, with a thinness on top of it, too slim to be a grown man, but which was Michael. The head was covered. The stretcher was going into the back of the ambulance. There were pills, bad pills, and a bad doctor, and he was dead. Damien watched, stunned and shaken, as the songs played one after another. Video after video, already history. The rolling skies of What About Us, the opening of the creaky door into Thriller, all the darkness of that song, his favourite bit, the heavy breathing to the beat of the music when Michael had just turned into the footloose zombie and the choreography begins. Michael Jackson understood the nature of evil, its presence all around. He understood that in being required to live side by side with it, we must learn to wear its cloak, to recognize it within ourselves. He knew that he had a demon inside of him, and he knew that it was the stirring, delicious energy gathering within him when he sang and when he danced. The music was what named him. It was bigger than him. And now the music was finally stepping out from behind the terrible, ridiculing shade of its creator. It was pure, loud, enrapturing, forlornly celebrating. Neverland was crowded with criers. The air was without Michael. He was ascending upwards, moonbound for his last act. The hypnotizing feet, a jazzful ballerina. And it was only now, finally, with all of this exploding before him, that Damien fully understood and recognized what it meant that his father was dead. It struck him with a new nakedness, a jolt in the gut. He was dead. He was memories and dust. He would never see him again. He felt the true clarity of this absence, the permanence of it, and tears came rolling down his face. For 2 hours he sat there, watching, the need for toast obliterated, all thoughts of work forgotten. He watched, snivelling, the talking about Michael, the dancing feet of Michael, his memories flooding back, these songs that had played through the dark rooms and tenement hallways of his childhood. Aside from the books, music was the second education his father had put to him. They had listened together and danced for a time in the days of Joyce. They had watched together the gradual, disturbing change, how he had moved further and further away from himself, trying to draw for himself a new face if he could only finish getting rid of the old one. The more Damien watched, the more it seemed that it was Lawrence's face staring out at him from the screen. He thought of him walking along Railton Road in his rumpled clothes, lying in the hospice on that final night, with that bruised, disappointed expression in his eyes. While remembering these things, an idea came to him. It was such a strong, clear, complete idea that when it struck him, he felt a flash of joy. It was an idea that must be dealt with immediately, before it ran away. He knew exactly what he had to do, exactly where to begin. He stood up. Rather, he rose. First of all, he went to the cupboard where his old manuscript was kept, found it, and threw it in the outside bin. He did not read it, not a word of it. He must not look at anything else, not a single word or piece of paper that might distract him. He must do only one thing, actually, a series of things. He went back upstairs, took off his shorts and dug out the old pedal pushers he used to wear when he was writing in his bedsit in Kennington. They were too tight, especially around the belly, but they were still the right length, just below the knee. Next, he threw the vest he was wearing into the washing basket, things to tend to later, along with brushing his teeth and having that shower, and replaced it with a red t-shirt. On his feet, he put nothing. No socks. He remained barefoot as he went to collect from the bathroom the basin that Stephanie used for her home pedicures on Fridays. This he filled with cold water, the colder the better. Carrying the basin, carefully in both hands, he went downstairs and placed it on the floor underneath the desk in the dining room. He switched on the laptop and opened a Word document. Then he sat down and put his feet into the water. It was just how he liked it. His calves were bare. His feet were cold. Finally settled, ready, he stared at the screen for a moment before bringing his hands to the keyboard. Just as he began to type, he remembered about calling in sick. Mercy answered the phone. There were wet patches on the floor around his feet. "What happened to you?" she said, eating a marshmallow.
There's been a death.
In the lost city to the north, Michael was surround sound. He was the hot high street air and the common song, blasting from car windows. Beat It, Whipped By, and then Thriller. Liberian Girl sailed down Westwood Hill with The Way You Make Me Feel on its tail. The music was the crying bright June, slipping through the leaves of the birches, soaring up to join the white smoke trails of passing aeroplanes. It was gloriously free now, this music, no longer shrouded by its maker. Now that he was over, the songs were as pure as their first days. Every beat was fine, the melodies pristine. The people were hearing them for a new first time, and oh, such wide, sweet lamentation. There was a sense of moonwalking. There was a desire to walk backwards. In paradise, out of respect and admiration for him, Rhea put on her one white glove and watched the songs on TV, transfixed. Almost as soon as they had returned home from the Beatnik, on stepping over the 13th threshold, Rhea's limp had returned. The same left leg, the same crooked gait. There was an ache in the left ankle which turned into a pain, and when the pain subsided, it did so only as far as the ache, and so she limped, up the stairs, along the landing, down the stairs. "Why are you walking like that?" Melissa asked her.
"It hurts," she said.
And not only that, but her hands became dry again, and pale. There was a white, powdered look to their surface. She had to use shea butter 4 or 5 times a day. As for the house itself, something had happened in paradise during their time away. It had deteriorated. Either it had happened quickly, over those 7 days, or it had been happening already, and now, on returning, it was more visible. It was no longer white, the slim stone facade, but a slight and murky grey. The front gate was rusty and loose on its hinges, and the sills of the window twins were cracked, big starfish weeds pullulating in the seams of the concrete underneath. Inside, the hallway was narrower than before, the floors and door frames more crooked than before, and the dust was like a snow all across the surfaces, building in its occupation. Giant dust balls had gathered in the corners. The white film had thickened on Melissa's shoes between the two wardrobes of the master court, where the accumulation was greatest along the headboard, for example, the picture rails, the bedside tables. Downstairs in the kitchen, a gash had appeared in the wall above the dustbin, releasing a sawdust when pressed, another kind of dust, which came spilling out onto the paprika. And strangest of all, there was a black wavy line going up the stairway, just above the dado rail, which Melissa was sure had not been there before. "Did you do this?" she asked Rhea.
"No, maybe it was Blake."
"He wouldn't be able to reach." Rhea shrugged and went into her room. Another thing that had happened during their absence was that Mrs. Jackson had gone. She had been taken away, to a home, a neighbour said. Michael no longer had to rescue her in the street on his return from the office, after the journey back on the 176, as usual wearing a suit, now one of 4. The suit was becoming a part of his shape. Even in this heat, he wore them, the jacket flapping open, and his slim hands hanging out from the cuffs. The khakis were no longer underneath. They were being worn away by the rat race, and the panelled ceilings, and the dead serenade of the photocopier, which was partly why he looked thinner. And partly, it was that he was thinner, and the bounce in his walk was lesser, as he took the road to Cobb's Corner in the mornings with his sanitising hand gel, which he was using more and more often. He had not mentioned the idea of marriage again to Melissa. He was trying to find a way to leave, but like Damien, he couldn't do it. He kept waiting for things to change his mind, which the children did every day. But not Melissa, though the children were almost enough. This is what happens to a man who was made for a great love, and not a suit when he does not feel the love. He closes in. He becomes weary. On the bus, he looked out of the top deck windows and saw less of life and felt less sturdy, less sexy, less rich. He was beginning to forget his magnificence. A darkness was coming down over his face like the pulling of a shade. Since Spain, Melissa had been attempting to banish from her mind all thoughts of Damien. She was ashamed. She was paranoid that someone had heard or seen them in the pool, one of the children, perhaps. After the event, she had slept on the sofa in the villa, the room buzzing and spinning from the alcohol, and the next day, she had found it hard to look anyone in the eye, especially Michael. She felt that she should tell him what had happened, yet she knew he wouldn't understand. He would take it at face value. So now it was another thing between them, which made being back in paradise difficult. The narrowness, the sleeping side by side, the daily routine. As much as she tried to force herself to carry on as normal, the chaos and disarray in her head was overwhelming. It was everywhere, in the walls, the furniture, the light switches, the sloping floors. "You have made the ground beneath me uneven," she said to Damien in her mind. "You have made poltergeist of everything that was still." The week after Michael Jackson died, she had a meeting in Waterloo with the Open editor, Jean Fletcher. They had dim sum, sitting on glossy black benches using black chopsticks. Jean was a dark, heavy woman with surprisingly bad dress sense for someone who ran a fashion magazine. She always wore primary colours, different combinations of them, and for this reason had been nicknamed by her colleagues the primary coloured woman. Today, she was wearing a red pleated skirt, a nursery blue sleeveless blouse, enormous yellow earrings and yellow sandals. Her weave was damp from the heat, wisps of it clinging to her temples. "So, how is everything with you? Your new life, your beautiful baby, your wonderful man?" She perused the menu. She ordered a heap of dumplings, the chicken ones, the beef ones. "I'm terrible," she said, when the rude waiter had gone away. "I start off the day with such good intentions, but by lunchtime I can't remember what they were." It had taken a long time for Melissa to decide what to wear that morning. She couldn't get out of the bedroom. She kept checking in the mirror, changing her shoes, which now were hurting. And misjudged, she felt, along with the flowered top dress, too hippy, and the neck scarf. She wasn't out in the fashion world enough anymore, in the world itself, for that matter, which is why she was here. "I've been thinking about coming back," she said. "Being on staff again. I miss the office."
"Really?"
Jean was amazed.
"You miss the office? Are you sure, Melissa? You don't miss the office. All that politics and bitchiness, you've just forgotten it. You couldn't wait to get away from us, remember? You said you felt like you were dissolving in vacuity. Those were your exact words."
She stuffed a whole dim sum in her mouth and munched on it. Jean ate in public places with a sheer lack of inhibition. She drank from ramen bowls, breakfast meeting bowls, all kinds of bowls.
"It wasn't that bad," Melissa said,
although it was coming back to her now. She had been desperate to get out of there. It had become unbearable, soul-destroying and demoralizing. Compiling lists of party dresses, the cocky photographers, the undernourished models, that basement office full of other women, only one man, the art director. She used to run into Bruce Wiley sometimes at shoots, and once she had even cried on his shoulder about how unhappy she was, after which he had tried to sleep with her, but she didn't hold it against him. Jean said,
"Anyway, my lovely, we're stripped down to the bare basics now with this recession. It's terrible. We've had to make redundancies. Malcolm's doing all the accounts himself. We've merged the fashion lifestyle and culture together to reduce overheads and a lot of our freelancers."
She reached over and put her hand on Melissa's.
"I'm sorry. We're having to let some people go, I'm afraid. We've got to do it all in-house."
There was a dawning, eating pause, during which Melissa was determined to appear unflapped. She looked down at the platter, the pale dumplings like warm dead brains, their stuffed inner selves bulging against the skin. They looked revolting.
"I fought for you. I really did," Jean was saying. "You're one of the best columnists we've got. But Malcolm's doing the sums. We just can't afford you anymore. We can't afford anyone except for ourselves."
She squeezed her hand again, leaving a shred of ginger on Melissa's knuckle.
I remember that feeling, though,
she said, after paying the bill, her treat a leaving present,
of wanting to get out. I felt like that when mine were very young. It's like going underground.
There was only a month's notice, and of course, no severance pay. On the tube home, people were sitting there in their suits and skirts and outfits, and she remembered being one of them. A swish hem, a ruffle here, some nice boots, a purposeful leather bag on her shoulder. She felt ridiculous and small in her hippie flowers, badly assembled. She leaned against the glass that separated the seats from the standing area, looking down at the carriage floor, and missed her stop, ending up in Crystal Palace. While she was there, she wandered into the park, around the ruins and among the incorrect dinosaurs, climbed the steps up to the stretch of gravel where the palace had stood before it had burnt down. Not far from the base of the transmitting tower, she found a headless woman in the grasses, a broken statue from the days of glory. Melissa felt connected to the statue. She empathized with it. She and the statue sat together in the sun for half an hour, and then she went to get the children and take them back to paradise. As she went inside, she became the woman who lived inside, and left the woman who had lived outside, outside. Because the doorway was too narrow for her to get in, and the hallway too narrow for her to walk along. After the days of glory, when the people had come from miles and miles and across oceans to see the colossi of Abu Simbel and the tomb of Beni Hassan, the Egyptian mummies, the hemp, the Welsh gold and the rhubarb champagne, the Crystal Palace embarked on its long and steady decline. Joseph Paxton, the father of the palace, was dead. His gardens and fountains no longer sprang with the bright silvers of flora and water. The shine no longer dazzled from the so many acres of glass in the ferro-vitreous roof, for it was dirty. And Leona Dare no longer made shapes in the air above that roof with her famous elastic limbs. A year after Paxton's death, there had been a fire in the north transept, leaving interminable ash. The sculptures in the Grecian court were crumbling. The frescoes in the Italian court were fading. At the top of the staircase, leading to the entrance at the central transept, a sphinx had lost its nose. In order to get rid of the dust, Melissa cleaned and hoovered every day, because she still believed that the dust had something to do with Rhea's hands. She attacked the swirling microscopic freedom around the TV. She clattered up the stairs with Mr. Miller, which she thought of now as a cantankerous old man, a little bit like her father. She went to visit her father, and she hoovered his house too, the armies of crumbs beneath the kitchen lino, the ash around the armchair. Cornelius smoked as she did so, insisting that he could do his own hoovering, even though he couldn't, and had trouble recalling the actual word, Hoover. The old house was like a shroud around her, full of bad memories and smothered resentments. "You didn't prepare me," she said, quietly to her father in the living room, but he didn't understand what she meant. He offered the children Eccles cakes and Ribena. Then they went to Alice's flat in Kilburn and had Ebba. Rhea didn't want any Ebba. She'd gone off it.
"What's wrong with her leg?" Alice said.
"I don't know," Melissa said. "I think it's the house."
"Did you put the onion and garlic? The pepper?"
"Yes, I tried it."
"Take her to the doctor. And make her lie down in very hot water, with salt."
"Sometimes night things could get inside people," Alice said. "And if this happened, you absolutely had to use the plantain under the pillow." It was the only thing that worked. That was what Alice herself had done when Melissa used to sleepwalk as a child. She had made Cornelius drive to Halston to get the plantain.
"One day you get a better house than that," she said. "Bathroom supposed to be upstairs."
In the car on the way home, Rhea told Melissa about a dream she'd had about the palace. She'd gone to the woods, and while she was walking another girl joined her, and they went through the tunnel and into the maze, had a boat ride on the lake.
"It was so funny," she said. "In the maze, we couldn't find each other. Then we bumped into each other and she disappeared."
"That's a weird dream," Melissa said. The doctor told them the limp would go with time, if indeed there was a limp. In the surgery, Maria was walking fine. When they got home, the limp came back again.
Are you doing this on purpose?
Melissa said to her in the hallway.
What?
Maria said. And just as she did so, Melissa noticed another black wavy line on the wall going up the stairs, on the other side this time. She stared at it.
I didn't do it,
Maria said, beginning to cry.
Stop it, Mummy! You're making my heart sick!
Garlic was reinstated by the front door, some onion on the bedroom windowsills. Vix was introduced as well, a film of it on the same windowsills and on the banister post under the skylight, with the cayenne pepper sprinkled on top. At the end of July, a card came through the letterbox addressed to Lily. There was no surname. A card of the same square shape had come this time last year, also for Lily, when Blake was just born. Melissa opened it. It was a birthday card from a grandmother who still did not know that Lily no longer lived here. She didn't mention the card to Michael. She put it away in a book, but she pointed out the wavy lines, insisting he take them seriously. I told you, somebody is drawing on the wall. Michael looked at it, still wearing his suit, sweating, dying for a slow red wine. The hall smelt of garlic, and he wanted to throw it in her face. Every time he removed onion halves from the windowsills, she put them back while he was at work. Now he tried to muster some convincing receptivity towards the far-fetched, and yes, crazy belief in the mounting supernatural happenings occurring in their yard. I'm tired, he said.
So?
She said, not hearing him.
Rhea keeps saying it's not her.
So it must be Blake.
But he can't reach. He's won.
Well, who is it then? You? Are you sure you're not doodling the place up when you should be working? This was meant as a joke, but it didn't land well because work was a very sore issue with Melissa at present. With the final open column filed and a job rejection from Vogue, a job she hadn't really wanted anyway, but rejection was rejection. Plus school was out. The country had entered the mass endless meandering of millions of small people over 6 maddening weeks, where the weeks got longer as they went by, and the days went slower inside the weeks, and September seemed a far mirage of mercy on the cruel and distant horizon. School was a box in which a child could be contained with worthy educating and in-house entertainment. The summer holidays were a swamp in which the dreams, lives, personalities, and everyday equilibrium of their carers were submerged and often swallowed. Yes, I'm sure, she replied, without a hint of a laugh or smile, while inside she was thinking, I know who it is. But she didn't say this out loud, because he would look at her again in that erasing way, and then she would disappear even more. Maybe it's time to call Ghostbusters, he said.
The Melissa who lived inside the house, and not outside, was further unimpressed. Why do you have to make a joke of everything all the time? Can't you take anything seriously? You're like a kid. You know what I think? I think it's us that's the problem. We're the ghost. We haunt each other. We don't work anymore. I had a dream last night that we were in a boat and I was standing at the helm, rowing across the Thames. I was mad. I was wearing this old grey sack dress thing and cackling like a witch, and you were lying down in the bottom of the boat, dead, completely dead. It was horrible. Is that what we're doing to each other? You're dying and I'm going mad.
Look, I've had enough of this, Michael said. I've tried and tried to make you happy and nothing ever seems to work. I give up. You're impenetrable. Pete was right. He said to me in Spain that no woman is forever. It doesn't last, and I really think he's right.
Has he told Hazel that?
How would I know?
Well, he should, Melissa said. She wants to marry him. He should do her the courtesy of letting her know he's not marriage material.
Oh, what? Like you let me know? That thing you said about not wanting to be someone's wife? Or don't you remember?
I was drunk, she said, looking away. I don't know half the things I said that night.
You said that wife was a horrible word and you were never getting married. How do you think that makes me feel when you say something like that? Don't you think it might affect me, even just a tiny bit? Sometimes I think you don't have any feelings, period. Not just for me, but for anyone. Maybe it's true, that dream you had. Maybe that is what's happening to us. Melissa had turned from him and was looking again at the black line on the wall. Last week in Japan, she had been in the detergent aisle with Blake and he was crying because he wanted to get out of the pram. And she wouldn't let him, and she wanted to scream. Something had smashed onto the floor at the other end of the aisle, some light bulbs, all by themselves, as if enacting the scream. Nothing is inanimate, she said absently. Everything is alive.
Really? That's good to know, said Michael, because I sure don't feel alive.
Desperate for his wine, he sloped to the kitchen and unscrewed the lid of the bottle. All through this dark and feverish summer, he drank like this. Before he had even taken off his jacket, a full stop at the end of the working day, an aperitif to some time-ish dinner. How deliriously and utterly he wanted to make love to her, to rise above all this friction and get back to what was important. But night after night, they slept like soldiers in the Red Room, estranged. Morning was a cold white hand that lifted them by their clothes and dragged them up, both of them covered in dust. The mildew in the wardrobes was thickening. The dancers on the wall were dwindling. The joists beneath the floorboards were rusting. One morning, Michael tried to bridge the hostilities. He got hold of her when she was coming out of the shower. She was all wet and brown and shiny, and her thigh was so thick he couldn't help it. His love for her was still deep and wide. It shattered him. It was destroying him. And while he knew that this was so, he wanted it to carry on until the last drop was poured out of him, even though he knew that there was no last drop, no end, no way out. He slipped his arms around her and became the darker brown against her caramel. But only limply she held him back. She patted the backs of his shoulders, friendly, distant, and did not appear to experience any particular excitement or even registration of the weight of his forlorn, warm sex against her leg. After an awful, empty moment, she extracted herself from him and dried herself with her towel. She was not there, the girl of the ocean. She did not put on her bracelets anymore, her rings. She was nowhere in sight. The mummies in the Egyptian court were vanishing. The statues in the Roman court were withering. The flowers at the entrance to the Assyrian court were dying. The arches of the medieval court were splintering. And Thich Nhat Hanh could not help with any of this. He said be present in each moment. Notice the flowers and the little animals. Feel the calming surety of your breath going in and out, going in and out. It was too basic. In fact, it was infuriating. And during a lunchtime meditation session, she threw the book across the room, hitting the picture of the twilight dancers, which then fell down, violently, with more force than seemed warranted. When she put the picture back on the wall, it was crooked. Every time she tried to straighten it, it gradually slipped down on one side again. The dancers looked so closed in their indigo, as if they also were trapped in their movement. Their arms were stiff and oddly shaped. Their feet were too small. After a while, Melissa no longer tried to straighten their world. She accepted that the thing that lived in the house wanted everything to be crooked, most of all, Rhea. She limped. One white glove on the Michael Jackson hand, and the other hand dry white. Sometimes she whispered to herself. She got clumsy. At Little Scamps one day, she fell over and hurt her wrist. In the park, in the playing fields, the swimming pool, all the places they went that summer to survive the swamp. She had that same crooked walk, and it always got worse the minute they stepped into paradise, where the woman who lived in the house was waiting in the hallway mirror to take Melissa when she looked into it. She had harder eyes and a thinner mouth. She felt much tighter inside. Joy was another country. Her smile was a jet-setter. Frantically, Melissa searched for ways to get back into her body. She went swimming and looked at the weather through the slats in the intermittent ceiling, floating on her back, and came out still floating, but the ground came back too soon. She went walking by herself in the evenings, without telling Michael where she was going. He would picture her, a flash of denim, glinting through the city, her tasseled boots, the way she walked, with a shy power. She went to the Tate and looked at In the Waves again, to see if she could get back that way. Another day, she went to a yoga class at the Lido in Brixton, where evening fell as they were breathing, and the teacher with his crossed legs spoke softly, almost inaudibly, about the way to peace. There it was, in the darkness of her, ever still, not destroyed, only disturbed by passing tremors. When the class was over, she walked with this peace out into the park. She saw the grass spread across the hills and the few shy stars in the smoke of the vista. Tenements glittered. Brixton was night blue. She skipped down the steps to the street, happy to be with herself again. But when she entered the house, it was like entering a cave. It seemed that everywhere she went there was a cave, the same one, with different entrances. On a Sunday evening, after a visit from his parents, he looked tired, they'd said. Michael was sitting on a chair before the window twins, shaving his hair. Out of habit, he waited for Melissa to finish it for him, according to the custom, to glide up with the blade from his neck to his crown, neatening the edges, rubbing at the stubborn patches. She stood very close to him to do it, her arms up over him, but this time he did not stroke lightly down the backs of her legs as she stood there. She was tense, silent. He was still, slouched. She rode with the clippers over his scalp and made tracks, brown paths through black fields. The shape of his skull. He closed his eyes. She went harder over the stubborn hairs that clung to him, and as she did so, she felt more and more taken that she was another creature. He could feel it too. "Careful," he said. "Sorry," she said. "Do it harder," said a voice inside. It was low-pitched and cruel. It was the other side of sadness, the voice of the dark. So she did it harder, and the voice went on to claim her body. And then the hand twisted, and she cut him behind the ear, drawing blood. "Fuck, be careful!" He slapped his hand over his ear. "Sorry, these clippers are blunt," she said. The floorboards upstairs creaked. Some sawdust slipped silently from the gash in the kitchen wall. In August, Blake got sick too. Red patches on his cheeks, temperature ascending. The doctor said keep him in, but in the house, the sicknesses were contagious. Melissa, the other Melissa, also tripped over, became clumsy like Rhea, bumped into things, or things fell on top of her. The lid of the Dutch pot on her foot, the photograph of her, Michael and the children on her head when she was dusting. All by themselves, these things seemed to fall, like the dust, a raining of certainties, of fixtures. One morning, she woke up and there was a small dent in her forehead, which darkened and became a scar. She did not know how it got there. It had no mother. The only explanation was that it was the real Melissa trying to get back into her body during the night when the doorways were more flexible and there had been a struggle. The night after that, she couldn't sleep. She was worried about being dented again. Michael's slumped form was turned towards the raffia. She had heard the twist of his bottle top earlier, the groan of the floorboards as he came to bed, smelling of Listerine, and the ghost of his drink. The floorboards were so loud now that they were like a demon presence. They were senile. She got out of bed and tried not to make a noise as she went out of the room. There was another wavy black line above the dado rail, this time stretching from the top of the stairs to Rhea's room. When she touched it with her finger, it smudged. And when she pushed open the door to the second room and looked inside, she saw Blake there, lying as usual on his front, his face to the wall. But Rhea's bed by the window was empty, and the window was open. She went down the stairs, past the wavy black lines. The window twins were silent and still in their frames, not moving, not open. The ecclesiastical arch was still attached to the ceiling, and the paprika floor was low and being obedient to its gravity. She had expected a chaos of structure, a hump of a hurt child in the back of the courtyard. underneath the open window, but she was not there. She found her in the bathroom, whispering. She was washing her hands. She was wearing her dressing gown, yellow, the same colour as Lily's.
"What are you doing?"
the other Melissa said.
"Oh, hi, Mummy. I went to the toilet."
It did not sound quite like Rhea's voice. It was deeper. "I know you did this," she said when they reached the top of the stairs, Rhea limping. One step, one slower step, one step, one slower step. She was afraid to hold her powdery hand to help her.
"It's fresh. Look, you did it just now." "I didn't. I didn't, Mummy,"
the little girl said. She let her go to sleep in Rhea's bed, but she didn't kiss her goodnight. Before she left the room, she found the box of crayons and felt tips and took it away with her and put it under her own bed. In the morning, she was going to make her lie down in hot salt water, like Alice had said, and she was going to go to the high road and buy plantain to put under her pillow. But in the morning, Rhea did not get up. She slept through Michael's kiss on leaving for work. She slept through Blake's coughing, through the early sirens, through breakfast. At 10 o'clock, Melissa went upstairs and put her ear to the door. They were whispering again. The whispering stopped as she went inside. The walls of the Renaissance court were quivering. The floors of the Byzantine court were trembling. She was lying in bed, wide awake. Her prehistoric hair was spread out around her face on the pillow. Melissa was afraid to go very close to her, but when Rhea smiled and said,
"Hi, Mummy,"
in her own voice, she went and checked her temperature, as a mother is supposed to do.
"Are you sick?"
she said. Rhea nodded.
"My throat hurts."
Her forehead was unusually hot.
"I think I've got Blake's thing."
She gazed up at her. Those bulbous eyes, their sooty sunrises, the innocent, reddened cheeks.
"Can you stay with me for a minute?"
she said. "Okay."
"A long minute."
"Who are you whispering to just now?" Melissa sat down next to her on the bed, feeling relieved. It was a warm and beautiful day. The sun was coming in through the window. It was tonsillitis, only tonsillitis, and Rhea was just herself, her uncommon child with her coming and going teeth and her imaginary friend.
"Is it Coco?
I thought you'd lost touch with her. Is she back now?" Rhea gave a coy smile and put the covers up over her mouth.
"No,"
she said, starting to laugh. She wanted to play the game where Melissa had to guess which of her invisible friends was in the room. There had been so many.
"Okay," Melissa said. "Is it George?"
Rhea shook her head, giggling.
"Is it Taffy Bogle?" "No."
"Charlie R?"
"Nope."
"Charlie K?"
"No."
"Shanana?"
"No."
Rhea laughed. "Oh, I give up." Melissa threw up her hands. "Who is it then?"
"You know who it is."
When she said this, she poked her arm out of the blanket for emphasis, the one with the hurt wrist, and the hand looked bigger. Also, her voice had changed again, that lower pitch with a wickedness in it.
"Who?"
Melissa said, beginning to feel afraid.
"It's Lily."
Now Melissa stood, took a step away from the bed. Rhea was smiling up at her as if she couldn't believe how stupid she was for not guessing. Her eyes were still very large, but they looked a different colour. There was grey in them, the colour of the dust. "Who is Lily?" she said slowly. But Rhea typically did not give information about her friends, only their names.
"Is she the one who's drawing the lines?"
She shook her head and folded her arms, adamant.
"Is she here now?"
Melissa said. A flicker of something passed across Rhea's face then, a worry. She glanced over towards the door to her right. Melissa glanced also.
"Is she? You can tell me. I won't tell anyone."
"Promise,"
Rhea whispered. "Promise." They did the wishbone vow with their little fingers. Carefully, Rhea turned her head again to the right.
"There,"
she said, still whispering.
"By the door." She always stands by the door.
Melissa looked, but saw nothing. She had never actually met any of Rhea's friends, but somehow she was expecting to meet this one. This one was different.
She's wearing a brooch,
Rhea said. A brooch? Do you mean a brooch?
Yeah, a brooch.
And the more she looked, the more she did begin to see a faint round shining by the door, the height of a little girl's collarbone or just below. There was nothing else attached to it, just the small round shine afloat there.
Can you tell her I don't want to go to the palace today?
Rhea was saying.
It's not nice there anymore, and I'm scared I'm going to get trapped in the train if we go.
The train? What do you mean? I don't understand. The voice sounded all wrong, and she seemed groggy. Melissa went to touch her forehead again, but stopped just short of it, almost out of repulsion. There was a fire coming off the skin. She needed medicine. She needed a salt bath. But to get the medicine and the bath, she would have to go past the door. She didn't want Rhea to go past the door, because then Lily might walk into her and take her completely, the way Bridget had taken Melissa. The only thing to do was to leave her here while she went to get the medicine. And anyway, she also remembered, she had left Blake alone downstairs in his high chair. She ran down, pulling the door open wide to get out of the room without touching the brooch. When she got close to it, she couldn't see it anymore, which made this difficult. Blake was crying. She didn't know how long he had been crying for. His face was soaked with tears. When he saw her, he cried harder, shouting at her for neglecting him. She wrenched him out of the chair and went to the medicine cupboard for the Calpol. Going back up the stairs, Blake trailed his hand along the wavy line, and she batted it away. And going back into the room, she shielded him from the shine, which became visible again once she reached the vicinity of the bed. That lullaby was playing from the chest. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's going to buy you a mockingbird. She could not remember having put the music on. You have to stop this now, she said to the girl in the bed. You're frightening me. You're not welcome here, do you understand? Get out. Get out now. Let me give her the medicine. Rhea coughed and lifted her head. She drank two spoonfuls of the Calpol and lay back down. She didn't want to eat. She didn't want to get up. So Melissa let her sleep some more, into the afternoon, relieved that she did not have to look into those dusty eyes or hear that too deep pitch in her voice. At 3 o'clock, she came downstairs. She ate half a slice of toast, a little cheese, and an apple quarter, while Melissa was running the bath. She ventured outside into the baking courtyard, but the sun was too bright. Soon, she wanted to go back to her room. She refused to get into the bath. Melissa backed down and gave her some more medicine, because she didn't know what else to do, and she was afraid of her, as Bridget had been afraid. She waited, wringing her hands together for Michael to get home, but by 8 o'clock, he had not come. It started to rain, with it thunder. The sky broke. Silver spears flashed through the clouds, electrifying the towers, knifing the air. A dark grey colour over everything. Through this sudden storm, sometime after midnight, Michael walked, with a loose whiskey stagger, over the hill, past Cobb's Corner, down the high street, expecting the house to be still and at peace, the small breathing of the children from the